Well, forgiveness week two, and before we get to the nitty-gritty of forgiveness itself, what I want to do this morning is I want to turn the tables on forgiveness, because of course, implicit behind any discussion of forgiveness is an unspoken acknowledgement that someone has been hurt or wronged. And so to talk about forgiveness, it means there's something that needs to be forgiven. And so I want to talk about the wrong that was done, which raises the question of forgiveness itself. Now, in the Jesus Path tradition, we have a word for these wrongs. We call them sin. The trouble, of course, is that for many, the moment you mention the word sin, it's like a cringeworthy moment. And it isn't exactly without warrant. I mean, for some, growing up in more of a fundamentalist background, sin often referred to what felt like these rather arbitrary rules. And so, sure, you might have the Ten Commandments and, you know, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, but it wasn't like it ever stopped there. There were often so many more rules. And of course, a lot of them had to do with sexuality, but then a lot of them just felt like killjoys. No drinking, no smoking, no gambling, no going to movies. It was just anything that felt like fun. And for many today, having left behind that sort of brand of faith, it seems to me that sin, the concept of sin, has gotten largely left behind as well. And I think a lot of that has to do with trying to purge Christianity of any sort of purity culture. Unfortunately for me, much of, I think, what we're seeing today in progressive Christian circles seems to be an exercise in creating an alternative purity culture. But personal sin, it seems, has been also replaced with the idea of the systemic. And so, yes, evil and wrongs occur, but they mostly happen at the level of the systemic, and the question is our role that we play in them. Now, the focus is less on personal sin, more on systemic, which is fair and needed. We have to talk about systemic levels of sin and wrong. The trouble, of course, is that the vast majority of wounds and wrongs that we experience as humans, they don't come from a systemic level, at least not immediately obvious, you could say. They come from other people, people that we know, friends, lovers, people at work, people in our communities, our parents. And so to get at forgiveness, I think, requires a better understanding of sin on a personal level rather than just thinking about it on a systemic level. So sin, how should we understand it? Sin, of course, in the Bible is an archery term that simply means to miss the mark. Sin equals missing the mark. And I remember a couple of years ago, Doug Hatton actually took me out to an archery range up in Waterloo. It was amazing. I'd never shot a bow and arrow before. But man, I caught on so quickly. Doug was like telling me I was just a natural Robin Hood, you could say. But the whole thing's so fascinating because you've got this target, I don't know, 100 meters away, maybe 50, I can't tell you. But it's down there and you've got to sort of learn to aim, right? You've got to learn how to balance gravity and all these other things that are happening. But even if you get good, like me, a natural, a little Robin Hood, hitting the mark, the bullseye, is next to impossible. I mean, when a target's that far away, it's just so incredibly hard to be that precise. And so when we think about sin, that is its truest sense, to miss the mark. But the trouble to me with that definition is that it feels like too tame and too broad. I mean, it could apply to virtually anything, right? It's like, oh, today I plan to do 3 loads of laundry and I only got 2 of them done. Oh, I guess I missed the mark. I guess I'm a sinner. It's just so blah to me. And so again, I think if we're going to talk well of forgiveness, we need better understandings of sin. We need an understanding of sin that has some actual teeth to it, which is where Mr. Francis Spufford comes in. His book, Unapologetic: Why Despite Everything, Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense. This is one of the most bold and gritty books I have read on faith in a long time. It is just such a treat. And his case in this book is he's looking at the Christian path through the lens of our emotions and how it makes sense on an emotional level. It's an absolutely phenomenal book. I can't recommend it enough. But my favorite chapter in the whole book was his explanation of sin. And what Spufford does is he argues that sin, of course, is a human universal. But all you need to do to remember sin. And what it really means is remember six letters. H-P-T-F-T-U. H-P-T-F-T-U. Just get that going around in your head like a bit of a jingle, a bit of a slogan, right? Like H-P-T-F-T-U, H-P-T-F-T-U. You know, just get it locked in there, because the moment you get it locked in there, it really starts to click. And for Spufford, and now for me, the idea of sin has become so incredibly simple. It's simply this, H-P-T-F-T-U, which means what? The human propensity to fuck things up. Now, I fully realize this morning that I'm running the risk of getting myself in trouble by saying that, and I promise you, I really did think through this. I tried to think of some alternatives that wouldn't contain that word, but again, they just didn't work because they didn't feel like they had teeth to them. I mean, consider some of the alternatives I thought of. What about this? Sin, the human propensity to mess things up. Really? Mess things up? You want to know what messing something up looks like? I'll tell you, because it happened to me this week. I was cooking one of those little hams. I put it in the crock pot. I didn't know you're supposed to cover it in tin foil, so I put it in my crock pot for 6 hours, sat down to the family to eat after, and when we cut into it, it was like so dry and tasted like chalk. Oh, it was, I messed it up. It's like, sorry, family, I messed up the ham. But at the end of the day, it's like, no harm, no foul. There's still other food in the house. We'll be fine. And that's the thing. Messing something up, it doesn't quite get at it. But what about something else, like sin, human propensity to make poor choices. Listen, I know this is a popular one today, telling people, hey, I think that was a poor choice. But really, again, where's the teeth? It's like, you want to know what a poor choice is? Here's a poor choice. A poor choice is making the decision at 7 years old to follow the Toronto Maple Leafs, to make them your team, to be a fan, and continually year after year making the same decision to support them, even though at this point it's simply an exercise in futility and following and being a fan of a dumpster fire. I could get a little carried away. But that there, that's a poor choice. Here's another poor choice. 11:30 p.m., you decide on Skip the Dishes. You know what? A Filet-O-Fish would be great for McDonald's right now. That's a poor choice. But at the end of the day, again, no harm, no foul. So that doesn't really work for me either. So why not go back to the archery image, right? What about sin equals the propensity to miss the mark? Again, it's just, it lacks any sort of substance. Here's what missing the mark is. For Kristen's birthday, I got her a seaweed scrub and wrap for her birthday, knowing full well that she doesn't love in any way strangers wrapping and covering her entire body in goop from the ocean. Now, even she had to admit at the end of the day that her skin was incredibly supple and smooth after the treatment, but I knew she didn't like it and I did it anyway. I missed the mark, you could say, with her birthday present. But a sin? Come on. It's not that. It just has no teeth. So why not then, you say, why not, Brad, go with the most theologically sound definition you can come up with? Well, here's mine. Sin is the human propensity to disrupt shalom by breaking peace between us and God, others, ourselves, or creation. I mean, I really like that. I mean, I think it's sound, but it isn't exactly pithy, and it sounds like it was created by somebody who's never really committed a serious sin. Do you know what I mean? And so I can't help but think, let's have the dignity to be honest about it. Sin is the human propensity to fuck things up. H-P-T-F-T-U. Is it crass? Sure. But I think sin is serious enough to be crass about, because what I'm talking about here, what H-P-T-F-T-U is getting at, is not just our tendency as humans to stumble and accidentally screw up in life. No, it's more than that. This is what Spufford says. It is our active inclination to break stuff. Stuff here, including moods, promises, relationships we care about, and our own well-being and other people's, as well as material objects. Our active inclination to break stuff. I love it, because now we're getting to the heart of the matter. FTU, I love it, because we humans, we do this stuff all the time in ways that are both big and small. And of course, the more big and obvious ways we do this collectively are fairly obvious, like what we've done to the environment or what we've done to Indigenous peoples in Canada or what the world looks like when it's under the scourge of war. But we also get this sense when we do these things personally, at least on a big level, this is what it means to have an affair or to be in the clutches of an addiction or using violence personally. These are the things we do and can do in our lives, and we immediately recognize those. But of course, there are so many other sort of slimy and subtle ways that we're inclined to break stuff. I mean, consider Spufford, he cites the example, the moods. Have you ever had somebody just totally disrupt and snap the mood of a room? It's like there are some people that whatever they're feeling, an entire room needs to feel this. My brother happens to be an expert at this. You know what? I can actually do this a little bit myself, but he's a little bit better. But we can be getting together for family Christmas, and if he's not in a good mood, the whole room will feel it. If he's miserable, if he's tired, if he's grumpy, it like takes whatever festive cheer is in the atmosphere of the room and just snaps it. That's what we're talking about here. Or you know what? Gossip is another great one, because you know what gossip really is? It's really just taking someone's opinion of another person and then just breaking it. It's like, hey, isn't that Bob? Isn't he a great guy? Oh yeah, yeah, he's a great guy. I love Bob, but don't you think he's a bit harsh with his kids? Oh, really? I mean, I don't know. It's just, there've been a few times that I've seen him be a bit nasty with his kids. See, it's little stuff like that where someone has an opinion of somebody and you just take that opinion and snap it or one-upping, right? We've all been guilty of this. Somebody tells a story. It's a great story. They've got all the oxygen and attention in the room. And it's like, I don't like that. Here's my better story. Snap, right? Or backhanded compliments, right? Oh, these are something, right? When you get a backhanded compliment, like somebody will say to me, my friend really doesn't like Nexus, but I told him it's a great community. Thanks? How do you even take something like that? It's those little barbs that get in your head and make you lose sleep sometimes. Or what about our social media rants where we're like, okay, we're angry and I'm gonna vilify a whole large group of people with my little rant here. And I know it's just gonna add more hate to the world, but whatever, right? Snap. Or have you ever been in a conversation with someone? Maybe it's someone really close, probably a partner, someone, maybe even a close friend, where you're maybe in a bit of a spat and you have that line in your head and you're just thinking, I know if I said this, it would hurt. And it's sitting right there. And despite knowing it will hurt, it comes out. I mean, you know it will hurt and you say it because you know it will hurt. It's like you've taken somebody's emotions or feelings and snapping it, our propensity to break stuff. You know, Francis Spufford gets to the heart of it here. The HPT-FTU is bad news, and like all bad news, is not very welcome, especially if you let yourself take seriously the implication that we actually want the destructive things we do, that they're not just an accident that keeps happening to poor little us, but part of our nature, that we are truly cruel as well as truly tender, truly loving, and at the same time, truly likely to take a quick, nasty little pleasure in wasting or breaking love, scorching it knowingly up as the fuel for some hotter or more exciting feeling. And I think this is the key to getting our head around sins. It's not those accidents that we make and we feel immediately horrible or we had no intention. No, it's those things that we want. We want the feeling we get when we break stuff. And the trouble is with HPT-FTU is that it is a human propensity. It's not the propensity of those people over there, the ones who disagree with us. It's a human propensity. It's all of us. And you know, I know culturally, guilt has come to be seen as a bit of an obstacle to happiness these days, right? But I'm inclined to think there truly are some things we should feel guilty about. And if we take honest inventory of our lives, I think what we'll come to realize is that there have been times in our lives where we have acted like wrecking balls in the lives of others, be it with words we said or moods that we've carried or ways we've just broken things, both big and small. And you know, I get it. I really do. I get it. Too often the Christian emphasis on sin has resulted in some of us carrying way too much weight in terms of guilt and shame. And for some, it's even morphed into this deep sort of self-loathing or self-hatred that's really hard to get by. But just because the emphasis on sin has at times manifested itself in unhealthy ways, it doesn't mean it's not true. We have to own parts of ourselves. We have to own that part of us that does and even wants to FTU. And you know, I know there's a lot of sentiment out there these days about how humans are beautiful and broken. And I think I also get that sentiment as well. I mean, I think some of us have propensities in our lives that can be charming and beautiful, but even if they're not fully appreciated by others. I mean, it's true that parts of ourselves might feel broken. They might feel of no value to others, maybe even mocked by others. And yet they're a part of us and they're beautiful. But that's only really half the story, I think. Because there's a lot of things about us that they might be beautiful in one aspect, in one light, but are completely ugly in the other. Because calling you, say, workaholism, you might say, oh, hey, I got a propensity to work too much. Hey, I'm broken and it's beautiful. But to say it's just beautiful is like burying your head in the sand and ignoring all of the ways that it hurts people, or calling an addiction a beautiful brokenness. It masks the real harm that it does. And listen, I got plenty of my own broken areas. And sure, on most days, I find some kind of beautiful aspect to them, but often they don't. I mean, I find my propensity to become overly emotionally invested in games of any variety, board games, games I watch on TV. Most days I find it to be cute. It's like, hey, what can I say? I'm competitive. Come on. It's maybe a bit broken, but it's beautiful. And yet, maybe it isn't. And maybe you realize that when, after one too many poor games, your kids leave the room crying because they're a little scared of you, you go, you know what? I've got this propensity and it's broken, and a lot of times it's just ugly. And listen, don't worry about me. I'm not one for extended self-flagellation. I have come to peace with most of my sins and proclivities in life. I sleep soundly most nights because, to be honest, I do think I'm trying my best. And that has to count for something, right? And of course it does. I really do believe that the vast majority of us on any given day are trying our best day by day. But even still, it doesn't negate the fact that even when I'm trying my best, I have the propensity. I have the HPTFTU. And the sooner we can all own that truth about ourselves, the sooner we can get to the rest of the truth about ourselves. Back in the day when I was the lead singer in a band, Autumn Vow, there's a CD out of us somewhere. I hope it never sees the light of day. Because the reality is I was in a band, but we were truly awful. And it meant that the only places that would really have us were the sketchiest, diviest of bars. I mean, just biker gangs, everything was sketchy. Everywhere we played was just sketchy. And I remember, though, you know, for the 13 people who stuck around to hear us play our set, it was often really late by the time we got to play, close the bar out, because eventually people would go home listening to us. But our big finale, our sort of thing that we did every night in bar after bar, is we would end the show with our big version of Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, right? And then we would go into this medley. We would do Stand By Me. We'd do some other songs and try to get the crowd into it one last time. But never forget, we would always throw in Amazing Grace. And it was the most fascinating thing to me, because late 1:30 a.m., you're doing Amazing Grace as kind of the night's winding down. And it struck me, because no matter where we were, how sketchy the place, the moment you started singing Amazing Grace, the whole bar, everyone more than half in the bag, would start singing along as if it was the national anthem of sketchy bars all over the world. And remember packing up our gear and drunk people talking to us, hey, you're awesome. And it's like, clearly you've had too much to drink. We're not very awesome. But that song always so resonated with people at the end of the night. And the things I would hear, people, patrons of these bars, separated from loved ones, their children who now despise them, they had this real tangible sense that they had just messed up their life. And a song like that gave them hope. I also have a friend who I've grown up with for years, and thankfully he's overcome his addiction to alcohol. It's more than a year now that he's been off of alcohol, but there were a number of years there where it was just absolute destruction he was sowing on himself and his family through his addiction to alcohol. And there'd be times where I'd spend time with him, a bunch of friends from elementary school, we'd come together and we'd hang out and have a few drinks, and he would have a lot of drinks. And I remember there was always this thing, because we love 90s music, right? So we'd be listening to 90s music all night, but you could always tell late at night when it was like, all right, things are time to go home. Because this guy, he would put on worship music at the end of the night, like just hardly coherent. He would put on worship songs, and I'd be like, all right, we're at worship songs, it's getting a little odd. I'm gonna head home. And every time this happened, he would say, wait, just one more song. And it would always be Amazing Grace. And I remember as the song was playing, this happened a number of times, he would look me in the eye and say, Pastor, almost mockingly, Pastor, is this true for me as well? It was so fascinating because the song sort of held these lyrics of promise that the grace can save even wretches. And it's powerful because when you look at the opening words of Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. You know, to many of us today, I think those lyrics actually come across as cringy. I mean, what kind of gospel good news has us starting with we're wretches? Of course, the interesting thing about the song is that a wretch might be actually an incredibly nice way of describing the author of the song, John Newton, who composed the song back in the 18th century. But John Newton was, of course, a slave trader. He made his living transporting ships packed with mostly black human beings who had been kidnapped from their homes, and he stuffed them into the inhumane conditions of the hold in his ship and carted them off to places around the world where they were treated their entire lives like objects to be bought and sold and brutalized. And John Newton was an active participant in this, probably one of the world's greatest crimes. John Newton wasn't just a wretch, he was despicable, a cruel nightmare of a human being. But here's the thing, at least he came to know that. You see, at some point he had some experience with God and he arrived at a horrifying conclusion about himself. He was a wretch. An awful man, at least part of him was. And the trouble, of course, with this famous story that isn't often told is that John Newton actually wrote this song while he was still practicing the slave trade. You see, the wretchedness he thought he was being rescued from by grace was booze and womanizing. But this is the thing about coming to terms with who we are, because once we allow that reality, that truth to set in, that we are HPT, FTU, that we have that inside us. Once you open the door and accept that, it keeps moving and convicting. It keeps doing a deeper work, exposing more and more of how we sin against each other. And when Newton discovered this part of himself and wrote this song, he actually became terrified of himself. And it's for that reason, right, in the second verse, he sings, and grace has taught my heart to fear. And a lot of times I think we assume that he's talking about God, fear of God. But no, what he's actually talking about is fear of himself, his own heart, and what he's capable of. Grace taught his heart to fear, and eventually it kept hounding and nagging at him until it showed him the evils of the slave trade, hounded by guilt, discovering grace even in his wretchedness. He finally gave up the slave trade and spent the whole rest of his life as a remorseful campaigner against the slave trade. And the reality is this, there are times when guilt and fearing our own propensities is incredibly appropriate and necessary. And why? Because we have the HPT-FTU. I mean, guilt is often an instrument of self-discovery. It tells us new things about ourselves. It leads us to new awakenings. And you know, there's a reason that song still resonates over 2.5 centuries later. For countless people, it has rung true to them because it has explained their own experience. Ultimately, it's a message of hope, right? Like, I might be a wretch, I might have that propensity within me, but that is not the only truth about me. In fact, it isn't even the greatest truth about me. But those other truths about who we are very hard to arrive at without first recognizing the wretch that is within us. The line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts. And you see, when we realize this, the idea of forgiveness, it takes on this whole new dimension. Because you see, the curious thing about the Christian path is this: as a path, as a way of life, it's impossible. It's impossible to perfect. It simply can't be done. You cannot travel the Jesus path perfectly. I mean, consider some of the things the Jesus path asks of us. Give your possessions away. Refuse to defend yourself. It asks us to love strangers as much as our family. Like, are you kidding me? It also asks that we really don't plan for the future. It's like, hey, fools, why are you putting money away for retirement? I mean, that's just foolish. And it's like, what? I mean, if you take the Jesus path seriously at all, eventually you arrive at an unsettling conclusion. No one can do this. This is impossible. It can't be done. But here's the even more vexing part of the Jesus path, because even if you should live up to all that the Jesus path asks of us, you do all the right actions, it also insists that our motives are in the right place, that none of those things, those actions count unless our heart is in the right place. So let's say you do in fact give all your money away, but part of your motivation for doing it was so that you would look just a little bit generous to others. Well, then on the Jesus path, it's like, well, that doesn't really count. Your motives and heart, they weren't in the right place. And it's like this Jesus path thing, it's impossible. Which is precisely the point. We can't do it because we've got the HPT-FTU inside of us. And that's the beauty of it though. Everyone fails. Absolutely everyone. We're all part, you could say, of the same species. I mean, think about cats and their level of ferocity, right, in the animal kingdom. You've got your big cats, your lions and your tigers, and well, if you've ever watched, you know, Discovery Channel, they can do some pretty serious damage some pretty carnal damage in the animal kingdom. They can cause serious harm, take down incredibly large beasts. Of course, you've got those big cats, and you can work all your way down to little house cats, the kind that never go outside, like my cat Frank, when he had Frank, never went outside. But he was capable of doing some damage inside. I mean, at most, it might have been, you know, pushing something off the table or smashing a glass. But all the way from big cat to the little house cat who does nothing more than maybe, you know, scratch up the furniture, all of them still have the same propensities. They all have the same sort of drive within them. It's the same view of humans on the Jesus path, right? We're all part of the same species. We're recognizable to one another. We all contribute, you could say, in different ways to the HPT-FTU. And some people, like John Newton, like Carl Seidel, of course, they act more like the big cats. A lot of damage they can do. Most of us here, again, are like the little house cats. Maybe guilty of knocking things off the kitchen table, maybe torturing little flies if we can catch them. But here's the thing, big cat or little cat, human, we're all a part of the same species. We're recognizably the same. We all carry within us the HPT-FTU. As Spufford writes, Christianity isn't supposed to be about gathering up the good people and excluding the bad people for the very simple reason that there aren't any good people. What it is supposed to be is a league of the guilty, not all guilty of the same things or in the same way or to the same degree, but enough for us to recognize each other. Enough to recognize each other. I love that. It's like whether it's the little tabby cat or the tiger, it's a cat. And it's the same with us. We're all in the same league, the same family, the same status, you could say. And this to me, though, is where if we could get our heads around that, it gets very interesting and profound, because when we can recognize each other as all part of the HPT-FTU species, something incredible happens. He continues this way. We come to see HPT-FTU is what flying a plane into a skyscraper has in common with persecuting the fat kid with his zits. It's what doing crystal meth has in common with having an affair with someone you don't even like. It's what murder has in common with telling a story at a dinner party at the expense of an absent mutual friend, a story which you know will cause pain when it gets back to them, but which you tell anyway because it's funny. Little, large, venial, deadly, in hot blood or in cold blood, done actively or allowed to happen through negligence, there's a look that the instances of HPT-FTU have in common. Elusive to summarize, but unmistakable once seen. A certain self-pleasing smirk. You see, that right there to me, I think is probably one of the most honest and grittiest explanations of sin. It's quite simply this, our propensity to fuck things up and to carry a certain self-pleasing smirk when we do. Do you know this experience? Can you recognize what I'm talking about in yourself? I mean, I don't know about you, but as Spufford describes sin, it's powerful to me because I can see myself in virtually every word and description he gives about it. Because the reality is I know that smirk, and I know it well. Those times I've gossiped and smirked inside knowing, finally, about to cut them down to size a little. Those times I've made that post, that dig at those people, smirking inwardly because, well, they deserve it. I know this, and I know it well. Maybe you do too. Maybe you can recognize what I'm talking about in yourself. And if this makes sense of your experience, if you're like, you know what? Yes, I get this, Brad. Then might I commend to us the words of Ronald Rollheiser, who says this, call it sin. Afford to them and to yourself the dignity of a rich and timeless symbol. It is rare that we hear someone simply and humbly say, beyond any reference to circumstances or excuse, I've sinned. There aren't any excuses outside of being human, and we are poorer for not being able to say that. And if you don't recognize anything I've been talking about this morning, then might I commend to you the words of Francis Spufford himself, who says this in conclusion. Almost everyone recognizes this as one of the truths about themselves. But you can get quite a long way through an adult life without having to acknowledge your own personal propensity to FTU. Maybe even all the way through, if you're someone with a very high threshold of obliviousness. But I don't think there are many adults to whom this experience has never happened at all. If you don't recognize it in the slightest, then I submit that either A, you aren't paying attention, or B, you are very, very lucky. Which brings us back to the question I asked us last week. The question about the Nazi war criminal. Because you see, the question that I asked you last week was an impossible question. Who of us could answer that? How could we possibly put ourselves in Simon's shoes? Who of us can know how we would respond? You see, but I mentioned all of this morning to remind us that forgiveness is not a one-way street. And for every person we might consider forgiving, my hunch is that we might need the favor returned in equal measure. You see, to discuss forgiveness in any meaningful way means not only learning how to extend forgiveness, but coming to terms with the fact that we need to experience it every bit as much as we need to give it. You see, while our crimes will most certainly never reach the intensity of the Nazi war criminal, truth be told, there will be nights for all of us. There will be nights, if there haven't been already, there's going to be nights for each of us where in the misery of not being able to sleep because of the weight of guilt hanging on our chest, you know, we might catch ourselves hoping that a hand would extend to hold our own and speak a word of forgiveness. We might find ourselves hoping that forgiveness is big enough for wretches and war criminals, and maybe even us. And if forgiveness can't reach there, then maybe our propensity, our HPT, FTU propensity, maybe it's not just a truth about us, but the entire truth about us. And if that's the case, then maybe we all are really just fucked. Next is friends. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Thank you for putting up with the strong language. I really just wanted to try to give sin the teeth and grittiness it deserves. And I hope I was able to accomplish that this morning, but I appreciate your patience for hanging in there. 2 more weeks on forgiveness, and I'm excited about where we're going. We're turning the page now, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty details of it. For this week, go in peace.